Okay, great. We'll get started here. And can everyone hear me? Okay.
Very well.
Yes.
Okay,
Yes.
good. Okay, good. I was telling Joanna when we got started, for those of you who are new, we work with EPA. In fact, we're sponsored under a different grant than the job training grant, and it's a grant that's up for a re-up. Someone just joined?
Eric Hummel with Oxnard City Corps.
Okay, Oxnard. And is that California?
Yeah, California.
Good, okay. Okay. We're under a cooperative agreement, HMTRI. We've been with them since the beginning of Brownfields, and we're funded under a research grant, actually, that I'll be talking about here, that helps existing grantees and prospective grantees with their program. We try to exchange ideas and see what people are doing so that different grantees could talk to each other. Between our annual meeting, we sponsor an annual meeting in Alexandria every year where we get the grantees together. But as I was saying, not everyone gets to go. And in between those meetings, we like to have this interchange. So we decide to have these 30-minute conversations every 2 weeks. The next one's on March 26th. And it's just a time when we could all get together and talk about whatever anybody wants to. It's very informal. We have a little agenda. Today we're going to be talking about diverse populations, but also we could change the subject on an instant if anyone has a question or interest in mind. And, of course, we encourage everyone to just break in or ask questions if you have any. We always start out with GLO, with news from Washington, and GLO's unable to make it today. She has a doctor's appointment, so she'll be back in the next session. But she told me to give everyone the news of what's happening for those of you who have submitted job training programs, applications. Joe said that they are being reviewed. They went past the first stage already and weeded out the ones that didn't meet qualifying criteria. Now they're doing the evaluation on the ranking criteria, and they're into it big time. They said that the award will take place in May. And, of course, you might say, well, it's only March, and why does it take so long? It is an involved process. They assemble all the people that start evaluating these proposals. And then, of course, once they rank them, that still has to go through a couple more review processes within the agency. So they're extremely careful on how they go about doing this. So when they release the awards, they're very sure that these are the best ones to award this round. And that'll happen in May sometime. So he said, hold tight, but we'll be hearing about that soon. Now, once you get the award, it does take a while to process it and work with the grants program. So usually, you know, you might get, when they start moving money around, it might not be till August or September. And you could start your program, though, once you're awarded. They allow you 90 days ahead of time to start charging things. So hopefully we'll have an annual grantee meeting probably in September, maybe early October, where all the new grantees and the old grantees come, and also any members of this professional learning community that want to come, who are serious about submitting next year, we invite them to attend, and they can talk to existing grantees and EPA people. So basically, that's the news from Washington. The other thing that came up this week in Washington was the president's budget, and it looked fairly encouraging. There's a big emphasis on environmental education. Now, having said that, the Congress says, well, it's not likely that we're going to follow the president's budget, but it does give you an idea of where they're going in the agency. There's a heavy emphasis on environmental education. And in the notes, I talk about the environmental education grants that are being awarded, and strongly I've urged the PLC participants to look into that. There's some information on how to track that. There are regional awards that are given for environmental education, and those are not as difficult to get as these national awards because it's a much smaller group. You're competing in your region for environmental education. Now, those awards are not the job training, environmental job training grants. They're more for general awareness about the environment. When you go to Earth Day fairs and you see posters and awareness types of environmental programs, these are usually funded by the regional offices grants for environmental education, and they're smaller grants. But the nice thing about them, and I think that it's synergistic to what you're doing in environmental job training. So you might look into it, and the information on how to contact them will be in the post-session notes. But it's something that it's while it won't impact your job training grant so much, it's something that the expertise that you have on board, and it would work well in conjunction with your existing program. In fact, you might even use some of your participants in, as part of this environmental education program. They're also emphasizing environmental cleanup in the president's budget, and they're asking for about $1.3 billion in cleanup funding programs, and a lot of that's for Superfund. But they're asking for a big increase in Superfund money, and interestingly enough, they're asking, I noticed, a $9.2 million increase in emergency response and removal funding. Now, this will also impact our job training grantees because, as you remember, when you looked at the RFP, the emergency response and environmental cleanup is one of the groups that would like and are participating in this environmental job training program. And it looks like there's going to be increased emphasis on that emergency response and environmental cleanup. So it's something to keep your eye on. The other programs that I alluded to earlier was this Brownfields Training, Research, and Technical Assistance Grant coming out of Washington. And that's, of course, the grant that we're funded under. Those proposals are due April 18th. And there's going to be a conference call, just like there was for the job training grants on March 20th. And there's also some notes on frequently asked questions. So we're going to compete. This is HMTRI. Is going to compete just like the grantees competed for job training grants. We've got to compete with various universities and whoever decides to. There's four parts of that grant. It's very involved. And some involves research and some involves community assistance. And the one that we work under involves working with grantees and communities. But those are the things that happen this week in Washington. And there's always something happening. We'll try to keep you alert and keep it into the post-session notes when we can. There were some job opportunities. And one of the things I've talked about that I would suggest you check out is Brownfields Renewal. It's called Brownfield Renewal. It's a magazine that's been around, since about a few years after Brownfields got started in about 88 or 90, 1990, magazine came out, and it's all about Brownfields. It's a commercial magazine, and they write articles about Brownfields. But what I like about Brownfields Renewal, two things. A couple years ago, we talked to them about starting a job board, and they wanted to do a job board and get the grantees involved, and we promoted it. The downside of the job board in Brownfields Renewal is a lot of the jobs are from companies like Aerotech and national search firms, and that's good and bad, but they're looking for geophysicists, they're looking for engineers, they're looking for people with master's and bachelor's degrees in engineering. But they've also, and we talked to them about this, that they need to also look at the technician area, and they have. And there are occasionally openings for techs. In fact, there's an opening posted there now. Company ASTI is currently looking for environmental technician, actually in Michigan, Brighton, Michigan, to do phase one work. And the reason I mentioned Brownfield Renewal is it's something you may want to check into, and we've got the address. It's brownfieldrenewal.com, and on there you'll see job board, and you can click on that, and you can even sign up so they'll send you an email when there's jobs posted. and see if there's something in your area or something that might be applicable. It's a nice little job board. I'm hoping that we can gear them more towards technicians, because you could put in your area, your community, and your expertise, and it'll show you what jobs are available. And we're hoping that they'll expand that. We're going to help them all we can to do that. The other good thing about the Brownfield Renewal is that they really provide an opportunity and a forum for people to submit articles. And you'll see on there, click on a section called Submit an Article or Submit a Press Release. And I would encourage all the grantees to use that. JFY used it very wisely a few years ago. They had about a 3-page feature article with pictures about their program, highlighted what they're doing, pictures of their graduation class. But even if you don't do a full-blown job training article with them, you may want to do press releases about your graduation dates. And it's a good national forum, actually, to promote your job training program. So again, we'll put those in the post-session notes so you could contact them. Some of the questions we had this week, one was on respirators. One of the grantees was seeking medical forms and had the question about respirators. And Ray, unfortunately he's not on the call, but Ray Sullivan from the Northwest Regional Workforce Investment Board in Connecticut has provided some really good guidance, one of our grantees, about that and about another topic we're going to talk about. But what he was saying about the respirators, it really, first of all, it depends on your curriculum and what you're going to be addressing. If you've got a wastewater program, you may not need to deal with respirators. You may, if you're going to be in confined space or in working with asbestos, you're going to need different types of respirators. This specific question that was asked this last week was about an asbestos program, and they were talking about what they needed to do in terms of respirators. And of course, Ray said, really, the specific respirator fit, and there's many kinds of respirators, really depends on the job, and the employer is required by OSHA to supply the correct respirator to fit the environment that the workers are going to be in. And that's determined, of course, by OSHA. But he does go on to add that no matter what kind of respirator they use, they need to have a health verification or a health certification. And this is something that should be of interest to our grantees and people considering a program. One of the things that you need to give your students, if they're going to be involved in something involving respirators, is a health verification. And you can get those. Many grantees have done this different ways. Some have made deals with their health department to do screening and provide the verification. And that's great. It's free, and you might talk to them. You might also talk to OSHA. This particular inquiry was wondering about forms, and OSHA, your local OSHA, would be the place to get the health verification forms for your state. But they would also and could also provide you the direction for getting those physicals. Several of the grantees have worked deals and leveraged their funding, like, as I said, with the health department or with some group in their community that will do the screening of your students. And of course, if you're going to be using respirators or if they're going to be in a respirator environment, even if you're not using respirators in your program, you may want to have them get that health verification, so when they start job hunting, it'll be one less thing that they have to deal with. One of the other questions that occurred this week was regarding a grantee who was starting his first cycle, and he was just beginning his first round, and he had questions about the selection and review process. And of course, in the PLC, we've talked about review and selection process many times over the years. We're going to take a slightly different slant for a few minutes and talk about diversity and how that fits into this selection process. As we said in the past, one of the most important things in developing one of these programs is getting a good team of participants together. And I kind of liken it, it's almost like selecting that, you know, if you were in Little League or if you were on a team, everybody in the group was out there and everyone would, you take turns selecting your team. And there's almost an analogy here. And it sounds a little counterintuitive. We've got a job training program where we're trying to help the community. That's on one side. And the tendency is to just, whoever wants to come into this program, come on in. But the other side of the fence that we have to consider is, unfortunately, we have very limited resources. Grantees have a very small budget. They also are required to place about 70% of their graduates. So what this points out to is it's a great program and it's really needed, but the funding and the resources have to be rationed, unfortunately. So the question is, if you have 20 seats that are going to give people an opportunity, you've got to be able to choose a team of participants who can fill those 20 seats, who have the best chance of success. They may not be the most needy. Unfortunately, they may not be the ones that need the most help. But they will be the ones that need help, but have the best chance of succeeding. And that's the approach you have to look at. You've got limited seats, and you can provide 20 opportunities for 20 really hardworking people, but you've got to find those people. And then just like we look at that analogy of the Little League team choosing sides, you're going to have to choose a team of participants that you think can work together and you can place, because 6 weeks or 3 or 4 months down the line, you're going to be faced with the task of placing those people. And the time to think about it is not when it's time to place them, but before you recruit. And when we talk about recruitment, we start talking about diversity of our population. And this is an issue that's come up for many grantees. Some, we've got grantees that are tribal. We've got grantees who are in rural areas. We've got grantees in small population areas, smaller towns. And we've got the biggie, the super grantees in the urban areas. And each of those is a little bit different. When you're talking about tribal, your demographic may be more homogeneous, but you're talking about a real mix of educational levels, of people with work skills, people who have never worked. And you've got some unique challenges in that recruitment process. If you're working in a rural area, we were talking to people in Nye County a couple sessions ago, and they recruit over a broad area, but they're recruiting people who are older. They haven't been in a classroom for 20 years. They're underserved, underemployed. They need work. And they've got the smarts, but they haven't cracked a book in 20 years. The question is, in a rural area like that, they may be sitting from someone who has just gotten out of high school or has been out for 2 or 3 years and is pretty sharp and his reflexes are quick. But he can't get a job and he needs one badly and he's willing to work hard to get one and reorient his life. So now you've got the guy who is very responsible, older, never cracked a book. You've got the young guy who may not be so responsible, but he's sharp as a tack, physically at his peak. And then you may have someone who's in the middle. This is when I start talking about diversity of our population for recruitment. I'm going to come back to that. But then we've got, that's in the rural and the tribal. When we've got the smaller populations in the urban areas, we have to narrow and we can become more restrictive in who we bring into the program. Because what happens in your, as your population of your target area increases, you're going to find more applicants for the program. There's going to be more people that want to get into it. The candidate pool is going to get very large. you get into OAI in Chicago, and they had an urban program. They had 1,000 applicants, 1,000 applicants for 100 positions, 100 positions for this job training program. How do you get from 1,000 to 100? And when you talk about the diversity of people, and I'm not talking about ethnic diversity, I'm talking more about experience, academics, need to work, will to work, attentiveness, and educational ability, you've got this very broad range. And so how do you do that? How do you handle this? And one of the ways we're finding that seems to be working, and different people are doing this different ways, but they're using a similar plan. The youth build and construction programs, if you have a program already, or if you have a life skills program in your organization, or you may decide to create one, you run your candidates through that. OAI, in that case I just talked about, had what they call tryouts. It's a tryout program where they actually made it difficult and did some pre-training. In all these programs, the theory is you run your candidates through a series of screens. You might have an orientation night, fill out forms, another orientation night, an interview night, and every time you do one of these nights, you're dropping people out. And what you get at the end of the process are people who are really sticking with it. They're willing, they want it bad enough, and they're intended enough that they're going to go through this. And this is how you start finding the most deserving candidates, even though you'd like to enroll them all, but that you're trying to bring to the front of the line the ones who are going to be at every session, the ones that aren't going to quit because it's too hard, the ones that don't want to work. And so you have to create something in front of this job training program that will get you to that point. And we see youth builds and what they do and construction programs like they do out in California. Arch Hanks' program, he'll run them through a construction program where he's giving them the construction trades that like general construction and some other trades and maybe even life skills. And during that process, they're going to say who's on time, who's there ahead of time, who never misses a session, who wants to learn, who can learn, and find out the students who are going to cause problems in class. And by the end of that first session, he knows, and they can pick those who go on to the next program, which is the environmental training program. So you're taking this diverse population, and you're bringing them down through a pre-training program, whether it's life skills, youth build, construction programs, or in the case of Ray's program, they set up a program called environmental awareness. It's kind of a LEADS program where they teach about general environmental awareness, and they're running them through a program, 35-hour program, that they can determine what kind of students they are and whether they're going to be standing at the end of the environmental program and whether they'll be placeable. In Ray's program, they don't care if they're ex-offenders. They don't care what their demographic is. They do give them a CASA test to make sure that they academically could handle it. Those who can't are given remediation training, which is something you also have to consider in diversity of training. When you've got a diverse population, and this goes back to those rural programs where you've got the young guy that just got out of high school and another guy who hasn't cracked a book in 20 years, can they do the algebra that may be needed, or can they do, if you need algebra, or can they do the geometry, or if they, you're going to have to teach them that if they can't, or you're going to have to incorporate it in the job training program. Now, you cannot, in the environmental job training programs, you cannot do life skills and you cannot give them a math course, but you can include it in the curriculum as part of, if you're doing a wastewater program and you've got volumetric flow in a stream, as part of that curriculum in the wastewater program, you could include the geometry flow calculations and how to do them as part of that curriculum. So you have to, you've got to think about that way back at the recruitment stage. And even before that, when you start thinking about the basic goals and objectives of your program, are you going to be recruiting urban, rural, tribal, small population, or urban? Are you going to be recruiting ex-offenders? Are you going to be recruiting women? Are you going to be recruiting disabled veterans or veterans? Disabled veterans, and we have many programs using this, working with disabled veterans. They may not need a fit test. They may not be going out on a job, but they may be working with phase one assessments or even assisting with phase two assessments. And they may be in a wheelchair, but that's great because they can work in City Hall doing phase one assessments. So those go back to your very beginning stages of when you're thinking of doing one of these programs. The first question you got to ask is who are we going to address? How many people are in that population, and how diverse is that population? And we have to recognize we can't teach everybody. But if we are, we better have programs that can take those who need help so that they all come up to speed. In talking to some of our instructors, the nightmare for a chemistry instructor is to have a class and have some people in that class who can't do the math or can't or they don't understand, and it's almost impossible to get the concepts across because they need remedial education. And the question is do you pull the whole class down? Or it ends up in a nightmare. One is the student gets disappointed because he wants to do the work. He wants to succeed. He's looking forward to graduation and his new career. But he's confronted with a job he can't do because he doesn't have the background he needs. And then he's thrown in a class with a bunch of whiz kids. This would happen to a fellow that's been out of circulation for a while, and all of a sudden all these young guys, and I just can't keep up, so he just drops out, which hurts everyone because it took away an opportunity for someone who could be in that seat. It cuts down your placement rate. It cuts down the number of people who are going to complete the program. So you really, again, we're emphasizing this, how to handle these diverse populations. So does anyone out there have any questions? This particular call is one where I've been talking. Sometimes we will also have discussions where we have one of our grantees basically talk about their programs. But some of you with programs that are going, have you been able to address these problems? Pam, have you been able to work with this?
Yeah, we do similarly to what you describe, Mike, in terms of, but I like what you said even more, really multiple meetings. We do a couple of screenings, and we make a lot of what we do is weatherization training, and so we make sure that people know you're going to be in a really small cavity. It looks like this. You know, the whole lift and carry, like up to 50 pounds, be on a ladder, like as much as possible to really give people the idea, this is what this job looks like. And that's useful, but I wish we could do even more steps. And hopefully, just in terms of this, if we get to do the environmental workforce training, I want to bring that into it, even more steps, so that people, before the final selection. Because that really helps us, because a lot of people do drop out. Mm-hmm. And right now we're doing youth build training for one of the youth builds in Philadelphia, and we're doing a new high school program. And boy, the attrition, they're physically there, but they're not mentally there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one of the instructors just told me, and this is a really experienced man, he said, this is the toughest course I've ever done. He's done like very advanced energy efficiency training. And we didn't have, this is a lesson, because we didn't have control over that selection. The school selected.
That's a
nightmare. I think going forward, we just have to be real with people. You know, you want to give this opportunity to the person who really wants to be there. It's tricky.
Yeah.
You know, when we have control over the selection, of course, we're, as you said, we're a lot more successful.
The really neat model that I've seen is they run, particularly if you have a youth build program and you start some environmental training, and you say, we have, and sometimes they don't even, I've heard where they don't necessarily even advertise it, or they said, they'll go to the best students and they'll say, we've got this advanced program for you. Now, you've got the construction trades, but if you've got the smarts, and we'd like to run you through this environmental job training program. So you're going to have not only the construction trades, but you're going to have you're going to have 7 or 8 or 10 environmental certifications that are going to make you more employable.
Mm-hmm.
So they almost do it like a reward for their best students. But you've got to have the luxury of having a big enough program to have that and enough students to be able to cherry pick the best.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's easy to say, but it's difficult. Art has you might have 60, 70 students doing construction trades, and then so he can cherry pick his best students to go into the program. And as a result, he gets 100% placement and no dropouts. You know, but
yeah.
Like I say, that's easy to say and much difficult to do. The tryout program is an interesting one that Tippi Reed has in Chicago. Now, they run them. They don't have that luxury of having those additional pre-application courses, so they just make it hard to get in. they have them jump through a lot of steps, and I think they do about a week's worth of – they might do some perhaps a week's worth of exercise types of things about environmental awareness. An interesting question I think we have to pose to the EPA is whether they would fund as an acceptable expense a pre-application training. I don't see why they wouldn't, because it's part of the selection process. But it would be, I think it would be great if, again, you have to have the luxury of a lot of, in your more urban areas, where you have a lot of people applying in your tribes and rural areas, you may not have the luxury of that many people even applying. Not that their need is any less, it's just that it's harder to get the word out. Anybody else out there doing anything that they feel is successful or difficult that they would see?
This is Ann Terry in Memphis, mm-hmm. Tennessee. We just completed our 2-year environmental job training program. We were awarded in 2011. And our goal was to train approximately 75 unemployed, underemployed residents within the city of Memphis, which included veterans and ex-offenders. We were, you know, very successful in training 105 individuals. We have a 95% success rate. So through our vetting process, we were able to come to screen down to the candidates we felt had the best chance of success, Mike, to use your terminology here. And, you know, our screening process is not as in-depth, I guess, as the program you mentioned, but we do an information session where everyone who's interested in the program is required to attend that information session. In that session, we go through a PowerPoint presentation about the training, the eligibility requirements, the intake process, et cetera. And then if they're interested, based upon what we share, we schedule an appointment with them. We have them to complete, an in-depth application and we do a thorough interview, behavioral interview questions. We ask them about their work experience and make sure they understand the nature of the type of work they're they think they're interested in, because this type of work is not a good fit for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they, pass that screening, we have a list of requirements that we ask them to bring, to determine eligibility, proof of education, residency, all of that. And then we do the drug screen. And mm-hmm. if they pass the drug screen, then we send them on to get their medical assessment. So we were very fortunate. We got started, a late start in recruiting, because initially when we applied for the grant, we had limited our recruitment area to 3 zip codes. But we quickly found out after 3 months that we didn't have enough people within those 3 zip codes. Those were zip codes that were heavily impacted by brown seals, but we didn't have enough people who expressed interest in the training, and so we expanded our reach. And now we have a pipeline of candidates who, are interested in going through the training. Should we get reawarded, we applied for the FY14 grant, and we already have a pool of candidates that, are ready to be screened should we get approved for that.
That's wonderful. You've kind of done a vetting already, and you've kind of informally gone through this funnel process where you expanded your target area, and it sounds like you have a good idea of those who are most likely to attend all the classes and succeed. And congratulations on your placement rate. That's amazing.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, the placement rate is not 95%, that was 95% of those who enrolled in the training, the completion rate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The placement rate actually, the placement rate is 113% because we proposed to, we proposed to employ 54 individuals, and we've employed about 62,
mm-hmm.
Because we trained more than we anticipated training. So we met our proposed goals.
Mm-hmm.
We exceeded, in fact, our proposed goals. But our goal is to place everyone who completed the training. So we still have less than 50 individuals that we're working with now.
How do you handle that diversity? Now, I'm not talking about ethnic diversity. I'm talking about diversity of experience and age and education. Did you find that you were narrowing that gap that so that everyone in the room was about at the same place, or did you find you were all over the map?
We were all over the map,
mm-hmm.
Even in terms of person's level of education. We had high school, everyone had to have at least a high school diploma, but we had someone with a doctorate degree, quite a few with master's degrees who, had the education but no training and long-term unemployed. So it was very diverse, male, female, ex-offenders, veterans, dislocated workers. We worked very closely with our workforce investment board here, as well as with faith-based organizations and veterans, outreach organizations to, come up with that diverse group of participants.
Well, I guess the advantage of that is, talking and Pam was saying, it could be a nightmare for an instructor, although it gives you an opportunity for peer-to-peer learning and teaching, where those who are a little faster or have more education can help out those who maybe aren't aware. And of course, it influences your curriculum too. If your curriculum meets the academic demands of your curriculum, you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't get too, you can't go over the heads of your lowest common denominator there, unless he's getting either additional education or help from someone or...
Right. So
that's a challenge, but it sounds like you've addressed that challenge.
Well, we did the awareness classes, which were a prerequisite to the HAZWOPR, HAZMAT, asbestos, lead, and mold training.
Right.
And that really laid a great foundation. And we're a nonprofit organization, so we had to hire training providers to teach the classes. And we were very, very fortunate to... get some really great training providers. NSAFE was, one of our training providers, and the instructor just, very, very good with engaging the students.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing he did was he had each student to introduce themselves. And while they were introducing themselves, he was taking notes, that would help him know how to engage them, in classroom discussions. Mm-hmm. He did fun activities, made it interactive to kind of, put everyone at ease.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to go back to his notes or recall from memory persons who had some, relevant experience that he could tie to, some of the activities he was doing. It was just remarkable to see him do that for, five sessions.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, we keep these to 30 minutes and we've gone over, but I'll try to put these all in the notes and and best wishes for all of you that are applying this. We'll find out soon. And the good news about this RFP that we're working on is that it gives me the indication that EPA is intent on continuing this program into the foreseeable future. They want to support the programs, and so that's a good sign. So hopefully we'll get some good news in May for everyone. So, well, great. It's been a good discussion, and we'll see y'all on the 26th. That's our next PLC. Same time, same place. And,
thank you very much. Yes.
You guys have a great week.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.